The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
End of term special today, Champions League. Homage to Catalunya as Barcelona take another Champions League against resilient old lady. Elsewhere in football, more on FIFA's shame. Anger grows over farce of World Cup assignment as tournament kicks off in Canada. The Women's World Cup, our correspondent reveals how 4 weeks and more than 500 misses isn't just an average month for Mario Balotelli. All of that plus postseason bits and pieces and special memories in this last pod for literally 2 months. Well, yeah, end of term. End of term, everyone. Barry, your trunk is packed. Mater and Peter are waiting at the gates.
I wish.
Yeah, Barry's here, everyone. Paolo Bandini, you're here as well.
I am. Hello, James.
Hi. Nice to see you looking relaxed, Paolo. And John Ashton.
Hey, James.
What are you thinking about, John?
I was just trying to work out how I could shoehorn a reference into me slamming a ball into Paolo's testicles at the weekend, but I just thought I'd
try to item one. I think we'll try and work out how to shoehorn a reference to the Champions League into that, probably, yeah, rather than the other way around. So how did this happen?
Oh, we were playing our annual game of five-a-side on a pitch out in Wormwood Scrubs, and during a goalmouth scramble, Paolo, having completed 5 minutes earlier one of the greatest sliding tackles you've ever seen from any Italian defender, denying me when I was through on goal. Mm. Yeah, goalmouth scramble from a corner, and I caught the ball, it just bobbled loose to me. I caught the ball absolutely flush with my left foot. I mean, if it had gone in, it would have been a real net ripper. Mm. Instead, it ripped straight into Paolo's groinal area from about a yard and a half away. Perhaps.
I imagine that some balls did go in, possibly, at that point.
Yeah, a little bit. Didn't get up for a few minutes. In the meantime, what's saddest about it for me is, yeah, I could almost have justified it to myself, the pain, if we'd managed to keep the goal out. But John then just tapped home the rebound for a far less exciting goal. And so I got no moment of pride out of that whatsoever, just a lot of pain.
Well, in other big matches going on this weekend news, there was the Champions League final in Berlin. What a cracking game this was. What a cracking game.
Yeah, it was a great final, wasn't it? You know, I think there was a moment of panic after Rakitic had scored, and then I suppose sort of leading up to a few minutes after that first save from Buffon on Alves, where you thought this could get a little bit Euro 2012 final, couldn't it? It seemed like Barcelona were just really coming after Juventus, and Barzagli, who I'd written a big piece saying it won't be such a big miss for Juventus Chiellini not being there, he did look ponderous, and I think, you know, he was obviously injured as well coming to the game, so I think that there was an element of that, and it just looked like Juventus weren't going to be able to handle Barcelona. But actually, in the end, I thought by the end of the half they'd really got a grip on the game, and they were playing well. The beginning of the second half obviously equalised, and then for a little while, but we're on top, and it was unfortunately just at that moment when you thought, hang on, they could do this here, that it turned around again.
Mm. Strong start to the game, and then Barcelona undid them with that extraordinarily easy-looking choral move, no?
Yeah, it was one of those goals where you just kind of burst out laughing when it goes in, because you could see it coming, and then when they actually pulled it off, it's just like, wow, brilliant, fantastic. And yeah, like Paolo, I thought the game was going to get away from Juventus. Did for a while. I think Barcelona were possibly, and it sounds really churlish to say it, maybe showboating a little and trying to be a bit too clever, and they squandered a few chances that you'd have expected them to score. And that enabled Juve to get a foothold. And what a foothold they got, because they were on top for 10, 15 minutes and thought they were going to go on and win it, and then just got caught up the field. And that's the thing against playing with Barcelona. How many men do you commit forward? How many do you leave back? And if you do commit too many forward, you are going to get caught on the counter. And that's one of the hallmarks of this Barcelona team, their ability to counter-attack.
Mm. Well, Juve exit with pride. Barcelona exit with their fourth Champions League in 9 seasons. Is that right, John?
That's right, yeah.
Wow. A few other stats. 2 trebles in 6 years. And Neymar's first player in history to score a goal in both quarterfinals, both semifinals, and the final of the Champions League.
Wow.
Wow.
And it's 122 goals, I think, between them, Suarez, Messi and Neymar this season, which is just silly. Astounding.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. Isn't it? Do you think anyone, given those numbers, John, could manage Barcelona? Is
Luis Enrique effectively the new Roberto Di Matteo?
No, I don't think that's fair. I think he's done a fantastic job there. And I don't think his contribution has perhaps been as recognised as it perhaps should be. Mm. You know, I mean, with when Guardiola did the treble, you know, obviously he was lauded as the next, not just the next big thing, but the big thing, you know, then, right. And was wanted the continent over. And the same thing doesn't seem to be the case with Luis Enrique, although he did have a bit of a bad time at Rome, didn't he?
It's a strange one with Enrique. I mean, he had a mixed time at Rome. I think there was a lot going on there that was beyond just him at that time. I think the one thing that I have always found with him is he's not going to protect his players. Like, he's willing to say, you know, this person did this and this person did that in public, which is something that I think a lot of the best managers, I think, don't do. I think that's something you would never see, I was going to say Mourinho, but that's when Mourinho has done it with some players, but he doesn't do it with the players that are in his starting 11, certainly. And I think that Rudy Garcia hasn't done that at Roma with the likes of Totti, and that's part of why it's worked better for him there. But I think that Enrique has put his own stamp on this team, doing, in particular at the back, they're much tighter at the back. I think they actually don't press quite as high up the pitch as they used to do. He has done things that are his own style of play. He has adjusted the way they play. So to say that he hasn't done something there, I think, is really doing a bit of a disservice.
Joe at Footy Joe kind of hints at a question like, would his Barcelona beat Pep's treble-winning Barcelona, the 2010?
It's a question that's going to make people very angry either way. But I think that this team with Neymar, Suarez and Messi, just by dint of having Messi, Suarez and Neymar, might well beat that Guardiola team.
Of course, Messi would also be in the other team as well.
Well, yeah.
As would a number of other players. That would be confusing, wouldn't it?
But for them particularly.
Luis Enrique's Barcelona, I think, are a lot fitter than Pep's Barcelona, who were no slouches, must be said. But, I mean, at Christmas, or at the turn of the year, Barcelona were in what for them was something approaching a crisis. They'd lost a couple of games. Messi and Luis Enrique had fallen out. Anthony Zubizarreta left, and he was an ally of Enrique's, I think. And he's managed to turn all that around, appears to have settled his differences with Lionel Messi. He's pretty much revolutionised their style of play. And as I said, they seem to be much fitter than the Barcelona of old. So I would say his input has been pretty important.
Interesting thoughts, Barry. But let's get the view of a man who's seen Barca up close there in the Spanish sunshine. Dr. Sid is on the line now. Hi, Sid.
Hi, Jimbo. How are you doing?
Pretty good, actually, Sid. Pretty good. John Ashton, Paolo Bandini and Barry Glendinny here. We've already done Barcelona. It's hard to know what you can really add at this point. But
It's true.
It's a glorious end of season in Spain with Sevilla winning the Europa League and a plucky Barcelona.
Yeah, it's gonna be good in I think it's Tbilisi, isn't it, where the European Super Cup's being held this year, Barcelona against Sevilla.
Oh wow, yeah. Yeah,
okay. I think so. Someone reliable, well, I don't know how reliable, someone informed me of that. We'll soon find out how reliable that is.
Sid, did Pique explain what he was doing with the net that he nabbed from the stadium?
He didn't explain this time because he didn't need to, because he'd done it before. Pique has this habit, taken from basketball, the idea of celebrating by cutting down the net and keeping it. Pique does it. He has, in previous finals, cut off little bits of the net and given them to friends. He's got, I think, a picture, I think it's Rome, but it may be Wembley, where he's got it framed with a picture from the match and his match day accreditation, and he kind of gives them out. And in the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, he had a bit of a battle to get the nets because the stadium manager wouldn't let them have the net, and he had to go around and get it with the help of Graham Hunter.
Great.
I think Graham assisted him in shall we put speech marks around this, convincing the guy to allow him to have the net.
Sid, of course, a lot of talk about Barcelona's legacy and how they'll renew with Xavi on his way. Actually, just one quick question about that. The people commenting on the site of Michel Platini, who voted for Qatar, handing the Champions League trophy to Xavi, who's going to Qatar, wearing a Qatar shirt. Has there been any uneasiness, especially given recent revelations in Barcelona, about the level of their involvement and love in with the Arab state?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of almost necessary to unpack that a little bit, and apologies if that makes for a slightly longer answer. There hasn't been uneasiness right now, and certainly there hasn't been, I think, that much uneasiness about about Xavi going to Qatar, because ultimately I think that's seen as a personal decision, that he's entitled to do what he wants. Whether, I mean, there have been one or two people, of course, saying not that comfortable about this, but that hasn't been a big debate. But of course, and I think we've talked about this before, there has been a significant debate about Barcelona being sponsored by Qatar. That certainly is true, which of course is made greater still, or more intense still, because that takes over from UNICEF. So, I mean, talk about jumping from one extreme to the other. That's kind of present, but not really because of Xavi's move.
Mm. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the future. Barcelona coming off a treble winning season yet again, but they'll need to up their game even further, I imagine, with a new Rafa Benitez rail on the horizon.
Well, or maybe they won't have to up their game.
I mean,
the level they're at suggests that maintaining it would be sufficient rather to continue being successful.
I was making a kind of cheeky reference to
it. Was just a segue into Benitez, wasn't it? Okay.
Mm.
would you like me to pick that up from somewhere else, or would you like?
No, that's fine. I mean, to the untutored eye, Sid.
Yeah.
It looks a little bit like a bit of a car crash waiting to happen, that Benitez.
Well, I mean, the truth is, it could be. I mean, we don't know. And I personally would defend Benitez on some levels, at least. I think Benitez, there was this sort of sense when the story first broke, broken, of course, by Filippo Ricci in Gazzetta. When the story first broke, there was a kind of an immediate reaction, said, well, he'll never win the league with Real Madrid. This is a guy that won the league twice with Valencia, an extraordinary achievement. Now, a lot of people then came and said, well, that was a decade ago and he hasn't won anything since Istanbul, which was 2005, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he's had teams that necessarily would have expected to have been as successful as that. And by the way, he has won things, but obviously not the league or the European Cup. I think that there is a belief that at least he understands Real Madrid. But I personally would argue that he understands a different kind of Real Madrid to the one that he's going into now.
Mm.
You know, the Real Madrid he left is not the same as the Real Madrid is now. It's a different president, which is one of probably the key reason why it's different. Potentially, of course, there could be some difficulties with some of the players. I think there is a feeling that the style and the formation will change, and I'm not necessarily sure that's necessary. The other thing is that maybe actually this is the perfect signing, because of course Rafa Benitez famously at Valencia claimed that that he'd asked for a sofa and they bought him a lamp. Well, Real Madrid is a club where you ask for a sofa and they bring you a lamp, a carpet, a couple of tables and a couple of chairs that you didn't need. And that maybe at least at Valencia he was able to win the league with that, and perhaps at Madrid he'll be able to too. I think it could go wrong, but he's a better manager than I think people give him credit for.
Mm. Well, his front room's going to look splendid anyway.
Yes.
Sid, just while you sign off then, what's going to be the big transfer story in Spain this summer?
Apologies for being boring, but I suppose it's going to be David De Gea.
Oh, really?
There's no doubt that he wants it to happen. There's no doubt that Real Madrid wants it to happen. Manchester United, I suppose, ultimately resigned to it happening. The question mark is whether they allow it to happen this summer for an amount of money or let him go next season for no money.
Sid Lowe in Spain. While he heads off for a little, you know, glass of tinted de Verano Palo, let's just finish up with a word on Juventus, who've now lost the Champions League or European Cup, indeed, six times in the final. Wow.
Yeah, and you know, the reaction in Italy has obviously been a lot of, hey, you know, we don't need to beat ourselves up over this. This team was only supposed to, by its own statements, you know, Allegri, Buffon, all these people were at the beginning of the season saying quarterfinals is our objective and that's where we're trying to go. And I think that while I agree with the sentiment to a large extent, I think there is a little bit of, you can get a little bit patronising with that. I mean, this club, you know, even Buffon said on the eve of the final, in fact, he said it a bunch of times before the final, you don't play in a final, you win a final. And so afterwards, he was very upset they didn't. And I think there's, you know, this club's expectations are that when you're in something, you know, you're aiming to win it. And so
they could have won it, to be fair.
Yeah, and they could have done. And I think that, you know, the takeaway for Juventus in the end, and there will be people who'll look at that team and say, oh, you know, it was over 30 years old average age. It was something like the second or third old, I can't remember exactly, team to play in the Champions League final. And they're going to say, oh, you know, is this just, you know, is this going to be a one-off? And I think that we can say pretty confidently it won't be. And the reason I say that is the club is now being so well run under Agnelli and Marotta. And to sort of illustrate that, you can look at the fact that the gap in turnover between Barcelona and Juventus is still something like 200 million euros. It's a lot of money. But that gap has closed by about 90 million euros in the 5 years that Agnelli's been at the helm. So it is a drastically closed gap already in the time they've been there, built this stadium, and they're going to earn 100 million euros from this year's Champions League campaign. The club is building itself back into a team that can be consistently in that top group in Europe, and that's where I think they're going to be.
All right. So in terms of the team next year, how many of this season's side or this Champions League side do you think will still be there come autumn?
I think a lot of them, actually. I think the majority, and it's going to be interesting to see how they make all that work with Dybala coming in, and they are going to spend more. They've brought in Sami Khedira as well on a free transfer, which is a great signing. You know, obviously everyone wants to know about Pirlo, who said that if they won the game he was going to quit. He may well still move on. There's definitely conversations happening about him moving to America or Qatar, but when he was asked about why he'd cried at the final whistle, he said, "I wasn't crying because I'm leaving. I'm crying because we lost." So there hasn't been a definitive statement on that. Pogba. I'm guessing you're asked about Pogba again because of the money that they've brought in. They're pressure to sell, and with a new contract, that's massively been reduced. There is no pressure on Juventus to sell him right now. The thing which I think might keep him there for another year is the Euros coming up, and wanting to make sure he has got absolute consistency in his game, knows what's going to be happening before going into that with France. He's not going to be there for his whole career. I think that's almost certain. But I actually think the chances of him staying another year have increased quite a lot in the last 3 or 4 months. So I think it's up in the air, that one.
All right. Top work, Paolo. Right. That's it for part one. Very, very shortly, Women's World Cup.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Busy times, of course, on the whole FIFA front. And this Wednesday the 10th, I think that'll be, Wednesday the 10th of June, you can join proper football journalist Owen Gibson, proper columnist Marina Hyde, and proper football academic David Goldblatt, and proper German Raphael Honigstein for a 90-minute debate about the future of FIFA, which is taking place at the Guardian's London headquarters. Full details for that, space limited, but full details on the blog. Well, I mean on the Football Weekly homepage, is that right? Yeah, that's right. So there you go. A proper debate about FIFA. Pow. Cool. All right, now, on this bit of FIFA, their exciting Women's World Cup has just got underway in Canada. Friend of the podcast, Caroline Barker, is out there covering the tournament for 5Live from Moncton in New Brunswick. And she joins us on the line now, despite the fact that it's really early in the morning. Hi, Caroline.
I actually don't have too much of a rum deal, James, because there are 5 different time zones I could be in Canada at the moment, and I'm probably in the easiest of it, only 4 hours behind you as we speak.
Oh, okay. Excellent. I'm catching up fast by the sound of it. Wow. What have you made of the opening weekend?
I've loved every moment of it. I'm not paid to say that. It has been most enjoyable. We had the hosts with a kind of Mountie-sized win over China in the first game, 1-0 win for Canada with a last-minute penalty. So that had a bit of everything. Netherlands then second up in their debut match, beating New Zealand. And then 2 thumping scores from Group B on Sunday, with Norway beating Thailand 4-0, and then Germany putting 10 past Ivory Coast. So it's had goals galore and plenty of atmosphere created in and around Canada as well, even though we are yet to see the games here in Moncton. They come on Tuesday.
Caroline, does that thumping Germany handed to the Ivory Coast suggest that there are some teams in this new expanded tournament that perhaps aren't good enough?
Well, when they expanded it to 24, there's 8 new teams in, 8 debutants in it this year, and I think you're always going to see those level of scores. You see it in the Men's World Cup as well, don't you? And well, Cote d'Ivoire,
beat Brazil, it was a similar story. Huh?
There you go. It's just the Germans doing what they do and putting a heavy score past the underdogs like Brazil. Germany 10, Ivory Coast 0. It could have been more. Ivory Coast goalkeeper actually saved quite a few towards the end, although Nadine Angerer, the German keeper, kept one out right at the end as well when she missed a cross into the box. I think these sorts of tournaments, you need to expand it. If they're going to improve the women's game globally, then you've got to look at bringing more nations in. on board as well. Ivory Coast, I think, will cause a few surprises. They've got Thailand up next, who are debutants too. And what's happened because of the expansion, you can have three teams go through from any one group. So from four groups, we'll see three teams go through. So arguably, you only need one win and you could make it through to the knockout stages. So what a dream that would be for Ivory Coast. I don't think their goal difference will help them, though.
All right. Well, by the sound of it, then England should be able to make it out of their group, but they're in a reasonably tough collection of teams. Opening game against France, who are highly talented, are they not, at this tournament?
Yeah, France are. England haven't beaten France since 1974 as well, and France have knocked England out of the last two major tournaments, the last time on penalties out of the 2011 World Cup too. So England going into it, and I've sat down and had a nice chat. It's very relaxed here. I've sat with Mark Sampson, the England manager, in a restaurant, just chewing the cud and talking all things France. Although he won't publicly say it doesn't matter if we lose to France, he knows that with Mexico and Colombia to come, who they should beat both those teams, then they'll be okay going through. And arguably an easier passage through to, say, the quarterfinals, because they probably would end up playing Norway if they finished second in the group. But no one wants to lose it. And they've been drummed in this kind of psychological advantage, mental advantage that England are trying to get going into this tournament. They've been doing all sorts of things, working on the colours of individuals and what that means with regard to their temperament, whether they're a fiery red or a cool blue. They've worked on all that psychoanalysis blarney, which some might say, but it's one of those things that they think will give them the edge mentally when they go up against France.
All right, super. Karen, the last World Cup was seen as a bit of a turning point, no, for women's football. How does this one compare in terms of the progress that's been made in the last 4 years?
If you ask the players what they loved about being in Germany for the last World Cup, was that it was a football-loving nation. So the supporters came through, they turned out, they got sell-out crowds, over 70,000 for the opening match. You don't have those size of stadia in Canada, for one. And of course, it's still ice hockey season. They're into the playoffs now. So that's very much the focus. But that said, they want to get behind it. And that win for Canada in the dying minutes against China on that first day, I think, has really galvanised the troops over here. And I think that we'll see more people coming through the gates. In Moncton here, we've got maybe 13,000. This is the smallest of the stadia. It's an old university stadia that they've put up the new bleachers, as they say in Canada, to one side and trying to get more people in. But only 13,000 that holds. And I hope they'll sell that one out, especially given that every corner you turn here, the signs are in French too. So there's huge support for France, waiting for them at the airport and the like too. So I think that we'll get a sellout for that one. And momentum will build. Canada need to do well, though.
Hi, it's Paolo coming in. I was talking to Julie Foudy before the tournament, and she was saying that for America, it's very much win or fail. I know that there's been some talk already that if Gillian Ellis doesn't win the tournament, she'll probably lose her job. With how good Germany are, and I appreciate we're asking you right at the beginning here before we've even had a chance to see these teams properly, but because the podcast is about to end for the season, I want to ask, you know, how do you see that? Who do you see the favourites there between Germany and the USA?
Well, USA ranks second in the world, Germany number one. Like you say, this is the moment when Hope Solo, the big names of world football, not just American football, need to perform. And there's a great advert doing the rounds on American TV that I've seen, talking about the guys not doing so well at the World Cup. We're doing better than expected. And now it's the turn, after all the face paint ran and the tears were cried, it's the turn of the women's team to really perform. They think they can do it. So narrowly defeated to Japan in the last World Cup. I think we've got some of the key older players for USA back, and we've got the younger blood coming through, and I think that they will perform. They're in, though, the older group of death. There's always one, isn't there? Group D, Sweden, Nigeria and Australia in that one with America. So they'll get a better run out than the Germans will probably in their group. Germany have got Norway up next. That will be their toughest game. But I think for the United States going through, they should be okay getting through to the final, and then we could see this battle upon battle. But the key thing, of course, for England as well is they're trying to finish in those top two, and if they finish in the top two in their group, they'll avoid the United States and they'll avoid Germany, and that equally will help England out.
Super. Caroline, just one last thing. One player to watch out for in this tournament.
Well, I can give you an England player and we'll try and rouse some hopes over that. And that would be the likes of Tony Duggan, I think, will perform well for England. We've already seen the likes of Sasic do well for Germany. She scored the quickest ever hat-trick in a World Cup, and I think she will continue to score plenty for them. So there's two. One for the England and one for Germany.
All right. Enjoy those time zones. Enjoy that Women's World Cup, Caroline. Look forward to speaking to you maybe in the new season.
Well, I'm glad you got me up early because it means I can go and see the tidal bore, which runs past my window. So that's a delight in itself.
It certainly is. Certainly is. Caroline, enjoy that bore. And I'll enjoy mine over here. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Caroline. Caroline Barker there in Moncton, New Brunswick. Right. On the subject of FIFA.
You've got to make me talk about John Delaney, aren't you?
Liam says, thoughts on Ireland's hush money from FIFA?
Oh, God. Well, I have in my hand a piece of paper. This John Delaney, chairman or chief executive of the Football Association of Ireland, before this hush money thing, sort of the press, international media picked it up and ran with it last week, he had a column in the Irish Daily Star. And this is what John Delaney wrote about Sepp Blatter. I firmly believe Blatter was the leader of a dictatorship. He was shameless. He hung on to power for as long as he could and surrounded himself with yes men. He believed he was invincible and had a sense of entitlement to his job. When he had the wind behind him, he thought it was a hurricane. Football has become mired in a cesspit of corruption in the past few years. Anyway, it's important the debate moves on, that we use this opportunity to change the culture of FIFA. I hope that this change finally happens in the sport I love so dearly and hundreds of thousands of Irish people love too.
There you go.
So that was, I think, the day before he went on the radio and made a just blundered haphazardly into this international scandal by, it was already in the public domain since last year, but nobody really cared. But now the international media picked up and run with the fact that the FAI accepted €5 million from FIFA to not pursue a legal case.
Mm.
And it was a legal case, which I'm no legal expert, but I suspect would have been absolutely laughed out of any courtroom in the world.
It would be unprecedented. I can't think of anyone who's been successful with an action like that.
It was based on a few different points, that the handball, a refereeing decision.
Right.
And the fact that John Delaney seemed to be very upset about the fact that Sepp Blatter made fun of him for suggesting Ireland should be the 33rd team in the last World Cup. And to be fair, Sepp Blatter had every right to make fun of him because it was an absolutely stupid suggestion. But Delaney then said that this money... I was talking to Matt Scott about this, formerly with this parish, yesterday, and he said... He was quite sympathetic towards Delaney because he said it was an out-of-court settlement, and with an out-of-court settlement comes a confidentiality clause. But someone leaked it to The Sun, or The Sun in Ireland got an exclusive on it last year, and that's how it came out. But Delaney, at the time of all this palaver over the Thierry Henry handball, said, look, this isn't about money, it's about integrity. And now it turns out he's taken what is, to all intents and purposes, a present.
Right, he's taking a present.
A loan that didn't have to be paid back. Right. You know, there was no reason for him to take the money, and Ireland's players are very upset about it. Keith Andrews spoke very well about it on the radio in Ireland last week, saying that, you know, at least we came out of that whole thing with dignity and our heads held high, and even though we were hard done by, but this handball by Thierry Henry, you know, which really upset people in Ireland. Mm. I wasn't that bothered about it. These things happen, but Keith Andrews said, now it turns out we don't have our dignity or our heads held high, but the players never knew about this payment, and it's a bit of a mess.
All right. Did you enjoy England fans chanting, he built your ground, he built your ground, Sepp Blatter, he built your ground?
I think all the Ireland fans enjoyed it, It was the high point of an otherwise extraordinarily dull game.
Right.
Which I would imagine the only thing that came out of that was Raheem Sterling with an overwhelming sense of confusion about why he was being booed. But that's a lot of Liverpool fans in Dublin.
Mm. Oh, hey, speaking of Liverpool, let's move on to a little bit of end-of-season business. Two moves, I think, have only been... only two moves have been confirmed so far in the Premier League. They're both at Liverpool. Is this right? James Milner going there and Danny Ings. I think that's almost settled.
Yeah, he's
now
agreed terms. Well, at the time we're recording this, which is around noon on a Monday, he's agreed personal terms with the club, but Liverpool and Burnley have to agree a fee because, even though it's a free transfer, because of his age, Burnley are entitled to compensation.
Liverpool, of course, are losing, though, assistant coach Colin Pascoe and first team coach Mike Marsh. Bit of comment about the fact that Brendan's effectively kept his job and watched his assistants carry the can. It's been some people's reading of that one.
Yeah, I guess it means there's no more buffer for him and that, all the sort
who gets the envelopes now? Maybe they were in the envelopes. Perhaps that's the names that were in there.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, I mean, he's now quite exposed because of these moves. I mean, there's no one else that can. It's all on him now, basically. And I'm not sure. I think Milner's a really good signing. I'm not sure that Ings changes Liverpool from a team that come seventh to a team that can challenge for the top four yet. I mean, he's got time to improve, but he's not quite that the player that they need, perhaps.
But he scored more goals last season. I agree with what you're saying. But he did score more goals last season than all Liverpool strikers put together.
Really?
Yeah.
Dick Advocaat is staying on at Sunderland, Barry.
Yeah, pleased with that. Mm-hmm. I believe some Sunderland fans set up a fund to buy Mrs. Advocaat a big bunch of flowers.
Oh, they're lovely.
And anything left over is going to charity. So it's a nice touch.
That is very nice. West Ham don't have a manager yet, do they? And they must be about, 2 weeks away from their Europa League opening game?
Yeah, that's coming up very soon, isn't it? I'm not sure what the latest is on West Ham's managerial search.
Harry Redknapp, I read, has offered himself as a director of football. I don't know how that helps particularly. But anyway, everybody else seems to be signing for other clubs. So that's out there.
I was with my mistress, TalkSport, yesterday, and Sam Delaney was sitting in for a poorly Max Rushton. Sam's a dyed-in-the-wool West Ham fan, and he's kind of a bit embarrassed about the whole West Ham thing, the way they're going for all these big names are being touted, and but none of them seem to have any interest in going to the club. So he was none the wiser as to who'd be getting the job.
So, well, that's pretty much it then for this season. Seems like only yesterday, John, that we were sat here talking about Southampton going down and Aston Villa winning the league.
Yeah, it goes so quickly, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? And I bet the next 2 months will fly by and we'll be sat here again. One or two little things just to finish off, as quick fire as you like, because I'm sure listeners have things to do. For a start,
yeah, they have to get on Twitter and go, when's Football Weekly back?
Yeah.
Which I expect to start tomorrow.
Well, I mean, bless them for doing so.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's finish off anyway with one or two little questions from listeners. Lim Stanley says, I'm a wannabe football hipster. I've read Inverting the Pyramid and dabbled in Coxian analysis. What next?
Well, if he's size medium, T-shirt-wise, I have a St. Pauli T-shirt you can buy off me, which I bought in error, which it doesn't fit me.
What were you trying to buy?
I was trying to buy an extra large one.
Oh, I see. Right, okay. Right. Ben Smith says, ooh, Leicester City have signed Christian Fuchs. Who are the panel's favourite players with rude names?
Well, my favourite's one from my childhood, and it'll mean we don't get an explicit tag, because it's former Chelsea midfielder John Bumstead. It always makes me giggle.
Right. But I thought Windass was pretty much, the non-plus ultra in that category.
Yeah.
There are loads of
there's lots of them. Yeah. Ben Smith also asks, apart from Gerrard's hilarious sending off, what was the moment of the season? Do you have one moment from the season which you carry with you?
Probably Blatter resigning would be, the thing that you'll take away. It doesn't feel like a season of moments, really, somehow. I don't know why.
Really?
I don't know. Maybe it's just my memory, but I can't think of any kind of defining moment of of the season, really.
I thought it was a pretty underwhelming Premier League season as they go, but actually, if I'd seen it, I think Paolo shipping one in the knackers from a John Ashdown thunder bastard would probably be my highlight of the season.
Right.
It was really clean as well. It wasn't like a bit of leg. It was just square on.
Nothing but nut.
There are one or two other questions. I'll just ask these quickly. Tom McGarry says, who will be the first Premier League club to sack their manager next season?
I was looking, actually. I think this is quite strange, because if you look at the 20 teams that are going to be there...
Oh, yeah.
Who's vulnerable at the moment? You know, if you look at the teams who finished just outside the relegation zone, you know, Sherwood and... Yeah. Your man at Sunderland, Dick Advocaat. Newcastle will have just appointed somebody. So, like, you know, they're fairly safe. And
Brendan's probably the most vulnerable,
well
is he?
Yeah, right, it could well be Brendan.
Good shout. Yeah. Okay, speaking of Liverpool, where will Raheem Sterling be in August, do you think, Barry? Still Liverpool?
No, I think he'll be at Arsenal, but not as much as I thought it several weeks ago.
Right. Where will Eddie Howe at Bournemouth, remember? Where will he finish the season?
In terms of placings or in terms of location?
Interpreted how you will.
He'll end the season at Bournemouth.
And in what position then?
18th.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Will Harry be back in the game by Christmas?
Yes.
Right. And finally, will Arsene Wenger have beaten Mourinho for the first time before we next speak? Because it'll be in the Community Shield, of course.
I don't think that counts.
Really?
As beating Mourinho, no.
Okay. All right. Well, do you know what? That's it then for this Football Weekly. There are going to be one or two bits and pieces and treats, as producer Ben calls them, available, I think, coming through if you have a Football Weekly subscription coming your way over the summer. But in a matter of weeks, frankly, we'll be back previewing the exciting 2015-16 season and all the delights that lie therein. Many thanks to you for your company over this season, though. Many thanks to your company today, Barry, Paolo and John, and producer Ben. And, of course, Sid on the line and Caroline there in New Brunswick. Have a super summer, everybody. We'll see you in August.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.